Thanks for joining us today on the Larry Mueller Show. We're talking about medication safety, and we'll learn some more about how pharmacists fit in the world of healthcare. I am Larry Mueller. Great to have you along with us today on WPR News. And our guest is Anne Graft Ladisa. She's a professor of pharmacy practice at Concordia University in Mequon. Anne's also a licensed pharmacist who works in hospitals. And we'll talk with her about storing your meds, what to do when they expire, and more. Plus, we'll hear more about the different roles a pharmacist can play. And I've been suffering from a cold for the last week, which means I may burst out with coughing or something. So it's good to have a medical professional right there looking, staring me in the face. Oh, boy. What do you want to know about the responsibilities of your pharmacist? Wondering how you can safely store your medications. The number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Professor Anne Graft Ladisa, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Larry. I'm happy to be here.
You teach at Concordia University. What kind of training does a pharmacist get?
Yeah, so I teach at the pharmacy school, so we're a professional graduate program. So our students come in and they've already done some basic science and other courses as a prerequisite to apply to pharmacy school, some background. And then when they are here at pharmacy school, it's usually about 3 or 4 years, depending on the program, and we teach them basic sciences. We teach them about pharmacology and pharmacotherapy, communication skills, things that are important that pharmacists need to know about working with patients.
And then when they're done, is there a test, some sort of state test or something they have to pass before they're...
Yes, if they want to work as a practicing pharmacist, they do need to be licensed. So there is an exam that they have to take, and then it's called the NAPLEX exam. And then they also have to take, in the state of Wisconsin, we have to take a law exam as well. So both of those exams have to be passed before you're a registered licensed pharmacist.
I had a friend who went through the whole process, and the testing's pretty substantial testing program. She passed.
Yes.
She passed.
That's great. Yeah, our students, here at Concordia graduated in May. And so a lot of them have been studying and sitting for their board examinations this summer. I've spoken with a lot of them, and it feels really good to have passed your exam and be able to start practicing.
Well, where else do pharmacists work besides, a neighborhood pharmacy, like Walgreens or CVS? Certainly where probably all of us have come in contact in that fashion. But where else do pharmacists work?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. When I first started, looking at pharmacy as a profession, that was kind of my point of reference as well, our community pharmacists that we see to get prescriptions filled. But pharmacists can work in a lot of other settings. So I work in a hospital. So there's hospital pharmacists that help with dispensing of medications and monitoring medications for patients that are admitted. There's pharmacists that work in clinics alongside of other healthcare providers. There are pharmacists that work in regulatories, the FDA, the CDC. Our public health service. So I understand you're going to be talking to someone with, about the Indian Health Service, that, that's a role for pharmacists. In the pharmaceutical industry, there's roles for pharmacists with, marketing and drug development lots of other little niches for pharmacists to practice that are maybe a little bit more non-traditional and not patient-facing.
What are pharmacists able to do and maybe not do as it relates to prescribing and providing medications?
Yeah. So pharmacists don't have prescriptive authority, so we can't prescribe medications. But one of the things as medication experts is we can make recommendations and kind of influence that prescribing, you know, in a way that's helpful for the patient. So if a patient, you know, is experiencing side effects of a medication, we might be able to make a recommendation for a different medication that the patient might tolerate better. Or if a medication is interacting with another medication, we can make a recommendation where that interaction is less likely. There are some pharmacists that do have collaborative practice agreements, we call them, with prescribers. And so they can work under that prescriber under a certain set of parameters and help to titrate insulin for patients that are diabetic or blood thinning agents, a medication called warfarin or Coumadin. And so pharmacists can help with actually dose management of that under these collaborative practice agreements. So these are kind of more long-term chronic medications that patients will, you know, take for the rest of their life. And in a lot of cases, and pharmacists can kind of be helpful in helping to make sure that they're safe and effective.
Why, and this does not happen to me, but somebody was talking to me about it. Why does it take a time to fill a prescription?
Yeah, I do get that question sometimes. So there is a lot going on in the background after a prescription is called into the pharmacy or you drop off a prescription at the pharmacy. So, you know, the pharmacist is making sure that based on, you know, what your personal health history, what other medications you're taking, making sure that it's, you know, appropriate for you, making sure, you know, looking at drug interactions, you know, making sure that it's in stock at the right amount, and getting it all ready for you. And then of course, you know, we want to make sure that you're using it, you know how to use it. And so there's some counseling and education that has to happen. So, a bunch of steps in there before you get your medication.
I'm always kind of amazed when I go in and I'm looking at pharmacists working and I'm thinking, man, you got your in your hands here. You've got materials that could, if you dose it wrong or if you mix it wrong, you could kill somebody. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's got to be a you need to be an exacting kind of person to have that role.
Yes, I think pharmacists tend to be people that are pretty organized, analytical, have a good degree of focus, and have kind of an eye on safety as well. So
yeah.
Yes, it tends to be one of our personality traits.
You would have taken a look at me and said, maybe you should try something else. I have a lot of admiration for those of you who are in this because I know how critical it is. And medication safety, of course, is important for everybody.
Yeah, it's a lot of responsibility. And so, you know, that's one of the things we also try to instill in our students is that sense of professionalism and, you know, taking care of our patients and doing the right thing for our patients. It's important.
All right. I've got my medications at home. What's the best way to store them? I suppose it depends on the medication.
Yep. It depends on the medication. There are some medications that need to be refrigerated. So you should always ask your pharmacist about that. And make sure that, it's not all, but some. One of the things that I think a lot of people tend to do is keep their medications in their bathroom. So But that's not the best place to keep your medications. Your bathroom can get humid and warm. And we really want to make sure that our medications are stored in a cool, dry place. So a closet, the upper shelf of a closet, kitchen cabinets are usually better, as long as they're not like, you know, right next to a stove or, you know, something that could get hot, or, you know, above some like under counter lights. So you want to make sure a cool, dry, they're stored in a cool, dry place.
So the humidity, I mean, it can affect, I guess, the degradation of the medication.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it can make the medication, the chemicals in the medication kind of break down, and it might not have the shelf life that we want it to have and be less effective.
Yeah. And what about those medications you got, you're looking at the bottle and it says don't use this, you know, this can be used for 3 months or 6 months, and after that, it's past its sort of use date?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so expiration dates on our prescription medications and on over-the-counter medications as well. So those expiration dates are the dates that the manufacturer and the FDA can say that they are at full potency and safe to take. So after that expiration date, they could potentially start to lose their effectiveness and or not be as safe to take. So we should pay attention to expiration dates when we're looking at our medication. I know sometimes we buy things over the counter. Like you said, Larry, you have a cold right now, so maybe you'll buy some cold medicine this week, but then maybe you won't have another cold for, you know, 6 months to a year. So it's always important to check those expiration dates on those medications before taking them again.
That was exactly the situation that I've been in. Okay. I'm looking in my drawer, you know, my medicine drawer, and I'm looking at all these cold things. I'm saying, oh, that one's done. Should I take it anyway?
Yeah. So, and also, like, you know, your pharmacist can help you with that too, as far as, you know, what you should take when you're having a cold. I always tell people to think about, you know, what specific symptoms you're having. There's a lot of cold medicines that have, you know, it's one product, but it might have 5 or 6 different medications in that one product. So you don't want to be taking medications for symptoms that you don't have. So it's always good to kind of think about what your symptoms are, and you can talk to your pharmacist at your community pharmacy, and they can help you pick out the right over-the-counter medication to treat your symptoms.
Ann Graf-Ledisa, our guest today, professor of pharmacy practice at Concordia University. She's also a licensed pharmacist who works in hospitals. And we're taking a look today at prescription medications and safety when it comes to those medications with Ann. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at pharmacists today on the show with our guest Ann Graf-Ledisa, professor of pharmacy practice at Concordia University in Mequon. She's also a licensed pharmacist who works in hospitals. It's great to have her with us, and I hope you'll join in with your questions. You know, one question that comes to mind is the store brand, sort of, or the generic, I guess, is the better term, versus, you know, the hotshot brand. Is one better than the other, really?
No, I think that generics are a great low cost alternative to some of those, you know, hotshot medications that you talked about. You know, I personally choose the generic medications. They're just as effective and they can be easier on the pocketbook. So,
yeah, I just over the counter, I took the store brand. It was like $10 cheaper. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yep. I looked at the ingredients and they looked like they were exactly the same.
Yeah, that's something that's, you know, always good to do. You know, on the label there, they'll tell you exactly what's in the product. So you can do that. And if you're having a hard time kind of figuring that out too, you know, ask your pharmacist that's in the pharmacy and have them help you guide you to, you know, a generic product if that's what you're interested in. Yeah.
Charles from Oshkosh has a question for you. Charles, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm calling about the test kits that have expiration dates for COVID-19. Are they still good after the date?
So the expiration date on the COVID-19 test kits.
Yeah. So I guess I don't know specifically about the different COVID test kits, but in general, those FDA expiration dates that are on there, again, just like medications, they're there to ensure that when the customer is picking it up, if you're in it, if you are using it within that date, then it is, you know, has the full effectiveness and safety with that it was originally intended for. So, so it's important to look at the expiration dates to make sure that, you know, you're getting what you're intending.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess, well, I'm sure it makes sense. Charles, thanks for calling. Appreciate it very much. Matt in Middleton, we'll go to you now. Matt, hello.
Hello. I was in the hospital several years back with a bad cellulitis infection and put on some antibiotics. And I noticed as some of the antibiotics were coming up, you know, to be put in via IV, that the pump that dispenses them would be set for a certain amount per hour. And the bag would say it had, you know, as an example, 1,000 milliliters, and it was, I'm just an example, it was supposed to be dispensed over a certain amount of time, but it was either going in too fast or there would be a significant amount left at the end. And when I asked the nursing staff and both the doctor, is that normal when you get, say, vancomycin coming up and it says dispense this amount over this amount of time and there's a lot left in the bag, is that normal for the pharmacy to put more in and have some left? Or I never got an answer from the doctors or the nursing staff, and the pharmacy never returned my call. So it made me curious, what's standard practice, and was that normal?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in a antibiotic, specifically the one you mentioned, like a vancomycin, that usually contains what, you know, the dose that needs to be delivered to the patient. We do have some overfill in the bag sometimes, so that because it's got to go from the bag down the line and into your IV. So there is a certain amount of overfill in bags like that. But there's some medications that are continuous infusions, saline fluids, or sometimes there's other medications that we run as a continuous drip. And those, if, you know, those are at a certain concentration and they run at a certain time, and when that medication is stopped, there may be some left over in the bag.
Yeah. All right, Matt, there you go. Thank you for calling. Mary in Plover, we'll go to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I'm an oncology nurse practitioner, and I couldn't make it work without my pharmacist. We talk about the doses of the chemo. We talk about what we can do for side effects. how that's going to affect, or if a patient has a side effect, what can we use to make the patient feel better? Like I said, couldn't live without them in that setting.
Oh, Mary, thanks for calling.
Thanks, Mary. Yeah, I know oncology pharmacy is a big a place where pharmacists can be part of a team, like Mary said, in taking care of those patients that have cancer. As you know, with chemotherapy agents, there's lots of side effects that patients can experience, and pharmacists can help, work with the patient to manage those side effects, as Mary said. So yes, a very a big place where pharmacists can have an impact.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mary.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Mary. Appreciate the call. Well, let's go to Dennis in Fond du Lac. Hi, Dennis.
Yeah, hi, good morning. The question I had, does your guest have any concerns about ordering online medications from, say, overseas, outside the...
Yeah, outside the U.S., yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, there can be concerns. We have a certain, standards that the FDA has set for medications we use in the U.S. And other countries don't have the same set of regulations. So it's important to do your research. We dispense, the medications that are verified, by the FDA. Not to say that, other countries don't have medications that work and are effective, but you just have to know that they're being evaluated under a different set of regulations and what those differences could be depending on where you're getting them from.
There you go, Dennis. Thank you for calling. Back to COVID tests for a minute. Suzanne emailed us says you can search for expired COVID tests or go to the manufacturer's site using the lot number. From the package, you can learn if the expiration date has been extended, because I guess sometimes they'll extend the expiration date. There seems to be a limit on extension repetition, but if you've got one that's all right now listed past the date, you can use that lot number, go to the company, and find out if that's been extended.
Okay.
Yeah. Good information. Thank you for that. We have Julie in River Falls next. Hi, Julie. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I am a retired hospital pharmacist, and the one thing I would really stress to folks is have a current medication list with the name of the med, the dose, and how often you take it, because that is a godsend when a pharmacist has to go in her patient's room and ask them what their pills are, and then we have to try to figure out, is this right or not?
Oh, man. I'm sure you're going to agree with this, Ann.
Absolutely. As a hospital pharmacist myself, that's one of the things that is so important, that we know what you're taking when you're being admitted, because sometimes it's emergent and you're not planning to go to the hospital. So I always tell patients, and I've done this for my parents and friends and siblings, have a card in your wallet, if that's the best place to, carry it, that has a list of your current medications, the doses, how often you take them, how you take them. And if you have a smartphone, take a picture of that card, or you can use the Notes app in your smartphone, but have a current medication list that is, as your caller said, that is so important to making sure that, we know what you're taking when you come to the hospital.
Yeah. Julie, thanks a lot for that. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Vern in Eau Claire County couldn't stay with us. He said He says, and I'm going to see if you agree with this, he says that crushing up Benadryl and putting it under your tongue can prevent an allergic reaction if you don't have your EpiPen with you.
I have not heard of that. I've not heard of that. You know, Benadryl is something that you can take. It's a histamine blocker. So sometimes when patients do have an allergy to something, that histamine blockade that can cause redness and itchiness, that's certainly helpful. Epinephrine is something when a patient is having anaphylaxis, an anaphylactic reaction. That's certainly a more powerful drug to take if you're having, you know, throat swelling, trouble breathing, tongue swelling, symptoms like that, an anaphylactic type reaction. So I don't know if I would put them in the same category, but certainly they've both been used for allergic reactions, maybe just different severities of allergic reactions.
Okay, Vern, thank you. You know, even if you're generally fairly healthy, chances are you're going to be prescribed a new medication at some point. It might be for short term, could be for long term use. What are the questions you should ask the pharmacist when you go that first time around?
Mm-hmm. Well, I recommend patients go to their same pharmacy to get their medications filled all the same place if they can. I think that's helpful because they'll have a record of what else you're taking. You can, when you have that, medication filled, they'll be checking against your other medications, making sure it's safe for you. And then you want to ask your pharmacist, how you should take the medication, how you should store the medication, like we said, and if there's any, other special instruction, how will they know when your medication is effective, any adverse effects that you should watch for, and how to manage those adverse effects. So those are all things that you can talk to your pharmacist about with your medication.
How often? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you mentioned that, but that's one.
Dosage. How best to take it. Make sure you're taking it the right amount of times a day. If you should take it on an empty stomach, if you should take it with food, sometimes that can affect the absorption of the drug. So it's important to know that. Or sometimes it doesn't matter if you take it with food or not, and that's also good to know.
Why do they say take it with food, for example, or don't take it with food?
Yeah, so there's a couple different reasons for that, depending on the drug. So sometimes medications are best absorbed on an empty stomach. So if you have food in your stomach, sometimes it has to do with the acid in your stomach, and it could break down the medication, or the medication is better absorbed in a more acidic environment, so they want you to take food, or a less acidic environment, so they want you to be on an empty stomach. Sometimes it has to do with side effects. So sometimes medications, when you take them, can cause some nausea. And if you have some food in your stomach, that helps prevent that nausea. So it just kind of depends on the medication.
Yeah, it makes sense. I never really understood exactly why. So that's a great explanation. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. And one other one that comes to my mind, just because I've had the situation, you'll get a medication to take for, let's say, 10 days. But 5 days in, you're feeling just fine. Should you still take the medication for the last 5 days?
Yes, you should. If you're feeling better at day 5, that's great. That means the medication is working. But it doesn't mean, for example, something like a short course, like an antibiotic. That's a great example of, you have an acute infection and you're maybe prescribed 10 days and you're starting to feel better at 5 days. But that infection could not be completely gone. It's just getting better and improving to the point where you're not having those same symptoms. But it's not gone yet, and you need to take it for the full 10 days, even if you're feeling better before those 10 days are done.
I'm one of those people. Well, it's good to know. I'm one of those people who doesn't like to take pills anyway. I hate even taking I don't even take an aspirin unless I'm serious concern here. So yeah. Take them all 10 days if it says 10 days or however long it says. Judith in Manitowish Waters, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello. I have heard or done some research many years ago about Synthroid, and that Synthroid would, over like 5 years, absolutely atrophy your thyroid, whatever it would be left of it.
Oh, we lost her. She wanted to know about...
Do the same thing.
She wants to learn more about thyroid and synthyroid medication interactions, I think, is what's going on there.
Okay. Yeah, so the Synthroid medication or levothyroxine is essentially a thyroid supplement. So your body produces thyroid hormone, but sometimes people don't produce enough for various reasons. And so you have to take that thyroid medication to help supplement it. And so it can interact. That's one that a lot of times we tell patients to take it on an empty stomach for absorption purposes and can interact with other medications or foods. And so sometimes you have to space it from other medications and foods.
We had another email. How do you feel about using online pharmacies like Amazon Pharmacy? How do you weigh saving a few dollars with losing the personal relationship with an on-site pharmacist?
Yeah, there's been a lot of innovation with pharmacy services and things like you said, the Amazon Pharmacy. I think one thing that I would make sure that patients know if they are opt to use those types of pharmacies is make sure you know how to connect with the pharmacy services that they have there. How do you talk to a pharmacist when you need to? A lot of them will have 1-800 numbers you can call or video chats or chats. So you just want to make sure that you're able to access the pharmacist when you need to, if you're using some of those online pharmacies.
Reese in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Reese.
Hi. Good morning. I have a concern with multiple medications and their interactions. Can you help me find a person, a pharmacist, who would do a detailed analysis of prescriptions prescribed by various doctors at various strengths and received from various pharmacies?
So a pharmacist where you get your medications filled, if they have a complete list, could do some of that comprehensive medication management. So they should be able to take your full list and kind of look and see, one of the things that can come up sometimes with people who are taking a lot of medications is something we call polypharmacy. So maybe they might be taking a medication that that is actually treating the side effects of a different medication. And then because they are taking this medication, we have to add on another medication. So sometimes de-prescribing is the best step in solution in some of those situations where people are taking a lot of medications. Not always, but sometimes. So your pharmacist should be able to, take a look at those medications or if at the clinic that you're at, if they do have an ambulatory care pharmacist that can help you look through all those medications and do a comprehensive review.
Reese, there you go. So just have the whole list.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. Mm-hmm.
or take a photo of them, a couple of photos of all of them, and then you've got them in your phone. That makes some sense, too. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Yeah, it's a question. How do you figure out if your medications are interacting with each other? It's kind of an important thing, I would guess.
Yeah, certainly.
Go ahead. Sorry.
So that should be some. I mean, we use a lot of technology in the pharmacy to do that. We have drug interaction checkers, you know, and it's not always black and white. So sometimes, you know, there's medications that interact and it is an absolute. You should not use these two together. There's very high risk if you do. And then there's some where, you know, they're kind of in the middle where, you know, if the benefits outweigh the risks, then maybe you do take them together. And then there's some where it's more like it's okay, but we should really be monitoring for these types of side effects that could indicate that there is an interaction going on. So there's kind of gradations of drug interactions, and the pharmacist should be able to kind of tell if, you know, if it's one that's severe enough where we need to look at getting a different medication prescribed, or ones where, you know, we'll just be on the lookout for any signs that, you know, it is interacting.
Anne Graft-Ledesa, professor of pharmacy practice at Concordia University in Mequon, our guest today. She's also a licensed pharmacist who works in hospitals as well. It's great to have her with us. Questions for her? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at pharmacists today on the show with our guest Anne Graft-Ledesa, professor of pharmacy practice at Concordia University in Mequon, also a licensed pharmacist who works in hospitals. And coming up at noon, by the way, we're talking about with two people from the Native American Center for Health Professionals to learn more about how they're working to improve health care for Native communities. Right now, we're taking a look at pharmacy and safety concerns as well with Professor Anne Graft-Ledesa. Before we go back to the phones, just back to a minute to Judith and Manitouish Waters, was wondering if that synthyroid, the medication, can it destroy your thyroid?
That is not something that it is typically used for or is a side effect. Like I said, it's a supplement of your thyroid hormone. And people take it when they have low levels of thyroid hormone in their bodies to help increase those levels. Certainly that medication should be titrated to the right dosage so that you're not experiencing hyperthyroid levels. So some of those symptoms would be feeling, you know, hot and sweaty, having a high heart rate, things like that, that might indicate that your thyroid levels are too high. And then if they're too low and you need a higher dose, then you might be kind of cold all the time, you know, dry skin, kind of feeling sluggish, fatigue. Those are some symptoms. So certainly thyroid medication is one that we do check blood levels on and make sure that patients are taking the right dose for them.
Let's go to Peter in Duluth next. Peter, thank you for calling.
Yes, my question was regarding cold medicines, Mucinex, pseudoephedrine, medicines like that, decongestants. Has any studies been done on the efficacy you know, the day after it expires, is it just totally worthless, or 6 months after it expires, is it 50% effective? And is there a point after so long where it might become dangerous to take, or is it just that the efficacy just dies off totally after maybe a year or two?
Yeah. So I think I would guess to say that one day after it's probably not going to lose all effectiveness, right? The drug might slowly degrade and be less effective. Now, to the point where, when is it not effective enough to treat what you're taking it for? I think that isn't like a, you know, black and white, at 6 months, it's no longer good anymore to take. Certainly, if the compounds and chemicals break down in that medication to a point, it could cause some harm. I don't know of any studies that have specifically looked at certain products, especially, you know, like cold medicines and things like that. There are certain, places like that might utilize some recently expired medications, that, you know, they might have, you know, at a free clinic. And I'm not saying that those medications are, you know, completely unsafe or not useful. But certainly if you're the one purchasing that medication, in your drugstore or getting that medication filled, you want to make sure that, you're using it before that expiration date.
Dot in Manitowoc, we'll go to you now. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. After my back surgery, I was in recovery, and at breakfast time, the nurse came and gave me, well, maybe 4 or 5 medications. And she wanted me to take them all at once. And I was of the opinion that you should take one, wash it down with water, wait, a couple of minutes, and take another pill, wash it down with water. So I think she was a little annoyed at me because I wanted to take my time at taking them. Was I wrong, or is this procedures?
No, I mean, you're certainly, I was thinking about a couple different things as you were telling that story. Certainly, you know, after your procedure, taking your time with swallowing, depending on the type of procedure that you had, or, you know, if you had general anesthesia, your throat might be a little sore, and certainly taking them one at a time is fine. Also, medications can be taken at the same time, certain medications. There are some where we specifically want to make sure that they aren't taken together. And so usually as a hospital pharmacist, we do have those notes on the medication administration record that the nurses use to administer those. And we might time them out specifically by 1 or 2 hours so that we can ensure that those medications aren't given together. So there are some instances where we don't want to take them at the same time. But a lot of times people, you know, they take their morning medications and it's just easier for them to just, you know, they're small enough. They don't, you know, some are big and you really need to take them by themselves so that, you know, you can get them down. But sometimes it's just easier for people. But yeah, there's some where we want to make sure we space them, but others that we can just, you know, take together. But certainly if you needed to take your time and taking them one at a time, that's fine too.
Janice emailed us, is taking vitamins before bed a good time to take vitamins for better absorption?
I don't know that I've heard about differences of absorption. There might be, you know, certain vitamins that have been studied in that way as far as you know, being absorbed better at night. There are definitely some medications that are better taken at night. I'm not sure about specifically vitamins, and as a blanket statement, just saying, you know, vitamins at night are better absorbed. I haven't heard anything to that effect.
Andy and Stanley emailed wondering why generics are so much less expensive than the name brands. There's a biologic out for Crohn's that is a fifth the cost of the name brand Humira, but not all pharmacies have it or insurance companies cover it. Seems like the big drug company AbbVie that makes Humira is trying to keep the generic off the market.
Well, when companies come up with a new medication, there's patent laws, so they have a patent on it. So, you know, they have the ability to manufacture that drugs, you know, by itself until the patent runs out, and then other companies can then make the generic medication. So, you know, some of that goes to research and development for those manufacturers who are coming up with these newer drugs and innovating and, you know, coming up with new compounds. And so, you know, that could be, you know, part of, you know, what why brand names are more expensive than the generic.
And just to follow up, if you're on a brand name drug, should you switch to a generic if it becomes available?
In my opinion, I think, you know, if it becomes available, sometimes if depending on your insurance might be lower cost, your copay might be lower if a generic is available, and they'll say, you know, you should take the generic now that it is available, and this is how much you're going to pay versus if you continue taking the brand name. So, you know, for, it depends on, you know, if what you can afford.
Yeah.
I personally think the generics are just as good, and I take generic medications and encourage, you know, others to do so if available. And it is certainly sometimes our insurance formularies, prefer the generics because of their lower cost.
Yeah. And let's say take a life event, pregnancy, maybe menopause, or maybe just aging in general, that might call for a potential adjustment to your meds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. That's why it's always good to, you know, kind of check in with your pharmacist or your prescriber, your provider that you're seeing, and let them know if, you know, medications don't seem to be working as well, or maybe you're experiencing new symptoms of something. It could be because of a medication, and we need to titrate that dose. Certainly as we age, the way we clear medications can change. Our kidneys are, you know, one way that we eliminate, you know, medication from our bodies. And as we age, our kidneys change. They become, you know, less able to filter some of those medications and clear some of those medications, and lower doses sometimes are needed as we age.
Well, Anne, this has been, I have learned a lot today. And I really appreciate the time you took to be with us. I hope we can do this again down the road. Thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, Larry.
Anne Graft-Ladisa is a professor of pharmacy practice at Concordia University in Mequon. She's also a licensed pharmacist and does work in hospitals as well. It's great to have her with us today, and we'll get her back, and we'll do it again. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the Native American Center for Health Professionals. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're going to spend the next hour learning more about the Native American Center for Health Professionals, which is based out of the UW-Madison, but with contacts and so forth all over the state, which is really, really cool. Couple of guests for you. Lauren Cornelius is the center's academic program specialist and produces a podcast. It's called Medicine Talkers. I've had a chance to listen to a couple of segments, and they're really good. She's been with the center for nearly 10 years and is an enrolled member of the United Nations. Lauren Cornelius, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Hi. Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
With us as well, Danielle Yancey. Danielle is the director of the Native American Center for Health Professionals. Based out of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, she's a descendant of the Menominee and Santee Sioux Nations and was raised on the Menominee Reservation in north-central Wisconsin. Danielle Yancey, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having us. We're excited to be here.
Well, excited to have you, as a matter of fact. And as you listen, as you're listening in, you may have some questions, and I hope you'll join in. Why does diversity in healthcare, for example, why does that matter to you? If you are a Native American, how supported do you feel by our current healthcare system? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And a quick reminder, I'm on the last legs, I hope, of a cold. And so if you hear some coughing going on, it's me. It's not my guest. And if I lose my voice, the two of you just keep going and finish it off for me. Okay.
Sounds great.
Let's learn some more about the Native American Center for Health Professions. What's the mission? And give us some of that history. It's been going on for a little while now.
Absolutely. And we're excited to share a little bit more about who we are. Our center was founded back in 2012, so we actually just recently celebrated our 10-year anniversary.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so a really big milestone for us to be able to celebrate a decade of programming and service. Our center was founded by Dr. Eric Brode, who is an Ojibwe family medicine physician that was here at UW Health, and really saw a tremendous opportunity for our university, our School of Medicine and Public Health to establish a center that would have an intentional focus of supporting Native American students who have an interest in health and that want to, you know, pursue and become healers for our people in our communities. So our center's mission really centers around five major aims. The first being, of course, the students. That's front and center in what we do. So our goal is to recruit more students into the health professions and not only bring them to the university, but also to support them while they're here. That's really paramount to what we do. Thirdly, we also have a focus around how can we incorporate more educational opportunities for individuals to learn about Indigenous health and learn about our tribal health systems across the state. A fourth area of focus for us is around the recruitment and retention of Native faculty, so who are practicing and also teaching in our institution. And then our fifth aim is to focus around our community and academic partnerships. So we recognize that we can't do this work alone, that it's really going to have the greatest impact when we're working in partnership with our tribal communities. So that's really another central focus of our center.
So the programs you offer students, is it support and in addition courses themselves?
Yes, it's both. So we offer a wide range of services around student support. So we do things like advising, coaching, creating a community space for Native health professionals. So having that built-in mentorship is really important. And then in recent years, we've been doing a lot of work around making available actual training and clinical experiences that focus on Indigenous health. One of the projects that we're very proud of is being able to create an American Indian Health elective course that's offered at the School of Medicine and Public Health. So it's the only course that's offered at the med school currently that 100% focuses on Indigenous health. So learning about federal Indian health policy, health equity topics, and then most importantly, being able to hear from our communities.
Yeah, that's very, very important. I was fortunate in my faculty job to work with Patty Lowe, who you probably both know.
Yes, we love Patty.
We do. And she's actually a guest speaker for our course. So she covers environmental health.
We were colleagues for a long time and played a lot of golf together, too. She's a pretty good golfer.
Wow.
But she also attracted to our department many Native students. It was a real pleasure for me because I had to advise. Part of my job was to advise students. And so she sent many, many very good students, Native students, to me for advice and help along the way. Mm-hmm. That help and support, that support is really critical, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think very similarly to what you shared about your partnership with Patty's, we do something similar in the health field. For us at NACHIP is serving as a connector for our students. So many of them have done clinical rotation at our tribal clinics across the state, which is, I think, a vital part of their training experience and also supporting their interest in wanting to work in Indigenous health in the future. And then all throughout their training program is offering that supportive space and that sense of community and also that connectedness while they're away from home, away from their families, while they're here on campus.
Yeah, and they have this, to some extent, the same kind of problems and concerns that any student has. But I've noticed that they're the very resilient folks. I could give you a lot of good examples, which I won't at this point. I want to turn to you, Lauren, for a bit because you host the Medicine Talkers podcast. And explain what, you know, who's the audience for that? What's the podcast all about?
Sure. So our podcast was created out of a grant initiative to reach more Native American students and get them connected with our center and hopefully spark interest in a possible health professional path. So we like to think as our audience is very wide because we're not just appealing to students or people that are pursuing an educational path, but also our community members, our grandmas and our grandpas, our aunties and our uncles who are exploring on Spotify and stumble upon our podcast and think, hey, this sounds really interesting and I want to connect my niece or nephew or my grandson to this program because it sounds like something they're interested in. So really using the podcast as a platform to connect our center with a wider audience and share conversations about Indigenous health, medicine, and well-being as it relates to Indian country.
Yeah. You talked to at one point in one of the podcasts, you mentioned Indianizing medicine.
Indigenizing medicine.
I'm sorry. That's indigenizing.
Right. Yeah.
Medicine.
Yeah, so it's all about looking at medicine and health through an Indigenous lens and how can we best provide care to our people in our communities in a way that is culturally congruent with our own practices and our history.
Yeah, that makes it. Maybe give a couple of examples. I know one of the podcasts that I listened to had to do with research that's going on.
Yeah, speaking of research, our latest episode that is streaming now on Spotify was about indigenizing research, and I interviewed several of our UW faculty members who are involved in research affiliated with UW-Madison. And and talking about how do we make it appropriate and respectful to our communities, and how are we using research collaboratively with our communities. So we are finding new ways to provide better forms of care specific to our Indigenous people.
Yeah, as I was listening to it, I thought, well, this would be interesting to anybody hearing about that research and some of the other ones as well. And you've got upcoming seasons and shows, I hope.
Yes, yeah. We are in pre-production for season 4, and we like to do several brainstorming sessions with our students and staff and faculty on campus to hear directly from listeners of what are topics that they would like us to tackle and like us to provide more information about. So one of the ideas that we have floating around for our next season is the intersectionality between sports medicine and traditional Indigenous sports, and kind of exploring that topic and how we find wellness through activities.
So what have you learned from hosting the podcast?
Wow, so much. That's a great question. This podcast was started in 2020, right as everything was shutting down from the pandemic.
Of course.
So I think when we had set out to create this podcast, we envisioned it as more of a collaborative process between our center and other centers on campus, like the Information Technology Academy, ITA, which is a pathway program for Native students who are interested in going into tech or into mm-hmm. the tech field. So we thought that it would be more hands-on with multiple partners, but had to pivot mm-hmm. due to the pandemic. So a lot of this was self-taught and, having some really great teachers via Zoom to walk me through what the equipment is that I'm looking at. So kind of familiarizing myself with that on the fly was definitely a challenge, but looking back now, I'm so glad that I had that experience. So yeah, kind of setting up my own microphone and my own recording system and researching, you know, how do you put together a show? How do you edit it and, create it from start to finish? So it's been, like I said, an incredible labor of love.
Wish I'd known you back then. I was teaching at that point. I was teaching a course on podcasting and broadcasting.
I could have used you. It would have been so helpful.
I think it would have been helpful, but that's okay. It's a joy, though, in a show, in a job like that, where you learn, well, like the one I've got, you learn so many things that you never knew you were going to learn about, and it's an amazing experience.
It really is. It took me down a path that I didn't see myself pursuing, but so grateful that I had this experience, and I feel like I've learned a lot. I've met a lot of people through hosting this show, and I learned something during every episode. So
yeah, I can believe that.
Yeah, it's just an amazing process.
Talking today with Lauren Cornelius, the center's academic program specialist, who we're just visiting with, and also Danielle Yancey, who is the director of the Native American Center for Health Professions. Great to have them with us. Questions for them, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and I want to just remind you that our next book club selection is coming up next week. And the title of the book is Blue Lake, written by Jeffrey Bolt, set in Wisconsin. It's a legal thriller, and I have found it's a page-turner, and there's still time for you to read it. That's coming up on Thursday, August 22nd, so next Thursday. Right now, we're visiting with Lauren Cornelius Center is the Center for Academic Programs. She's the center's academic program specialist for the Native American Center for Health Professions. And Danielle Yancey is the director of the center. And we're talking about what the center is all about, and certainly are doing a lot of really interesting work, and I'm glad to have them with us today. Questions for them? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. So why does diversity in healthcare matter to you? If you're a Native American, how supported do you feel by our current healthcare system? Join in the conversation. Love to hear from you. Danielle, let me turn back to you. What are some of the difficulties that our Native communities face when it comes to the healthcare system?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one area that our center really strives to address is around workforce development. We see some significant workforce shortages in particularly in tribal clinics and in the Indian Health Service. So one of our focal points is creating more awareness about opportunities for health professionals to work in our tribal health systems. And secondly, how are we ensuring that students have the opportunity to explore that during their training program and have those networking opportunities. One of the unique features of our center is we have our tribal engagement office, which is led by our assistant director, Melissa Matoxin, who's also a member of the Oneida Nation. And we've been very blessed to have a wonderful partnership with the Oneida Nation. And that office is located within the Oneida Community Health Center. And through that office, we coordinate with different tribal clinics so students can go and do rotations, meet medical and health directors in our systems, and be able to network and explore those future opportunities when they're finished with their training. So I would say workforce development is definitely top of the list.
And there are, I'm trying to think of the number of clinics. I think there are about 13, 14 of them, something like that, around the state.
Yes, we have 11 federally recognized tribes in Wisconsin, each which operates their own health system. We have one of our tribal communities who has two clinic locations, and then we also have an urban Indian health center in Milwaukee, which is the Gerald Ignace Indian Health Center.
So the students, when they've reached a certain point in their career as a student, have a chance to go out and maybe even intern at those places.
Yes, absolutely. And we've had a large number of students, both Native and non-Native students, who have gone and did rotations there and had wonderful experiences with our clinic partners. And one thing I just want to say is that we're extremely grateful to our community clinic partners for opening their doors and welcoming our students to come in and support their training.
Yeah, that's great. Osama Namaki is from the Menominee Reservation and has a comment for us. Let's go there. Osawa?
Yes, I have a suggestion for your podcast. I would like to know how the treaties interact with Indian health this day and age. I know it's of great importance to all of the tribes, so I would like to suggest that as a podcast. I don't know, you guys can bring to light whatever you think is germane to that issue. And say, well, Landon, for the opportunity to ask you the question.
Well, thank you very much for calling. Let's get comments from both of our guests here. Start with you, Lauren, since it's your podcast.
Yeah, of course. Well, Landon, for your suggestion, I think that's a great idea for a future episode. And yeah, we are very familiar with the importance of the history that treaties have in connection with health, and that there is a federal recognition of providing health care for Indigenous people. And it's actually one of the topics that the course covers as a prerequisite for students who are thinking about rotating. at a tribal clinic. So I think there's some great synergy there to be able to share more in depth on the history that treaties have with healthcare for Indigenous peoples.
Yeah. Danielle, do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, I also want to just say Wawan and Katanin for that comment and recommendation. And I agree with Lauren that that's a great intersection between our course and the podcast, because we actually start out the course by first talking about land and history and treaty agreements and how that supports access to health care. You know, in our treaty language, it says the promise of proper care and protection of Indigenous peoples in those treaty rights. So we talk about that history. And so we would love to collab and bring that from the classroom into the podcast.
Sounds like you've got a built-in expert there, too, because whoever's teaching that segment is probably be the person you'd want to
Yeah, exactly. It'd be an easy ask, and hopefully they'd be willing to come on the podcast.
Roughly how many Native Americans are employed in the health fields? We have any idea?
Oh, wow, that's a great question. I don't know the statistics across all of the health professions, but I can say when focusing primarily on medicine, there was a significant report that was created a few years back. It was a collaboration between the Association of American Indian Physicians and the Association of American Medical Colleges, and looking at representation of American Indian Alaska Native physicians in the workforce. And what they found is less than 0.5% of active physicians across the country identified as American Indian Alaska Native. So that's a national statistic. And I would also just further say that that's been a statistic that has been pretty steady for several decades. So again, it's one of the big drivers around, you know, our efforts to get out there, create more awareness about opportunities to work in the health field, the significant need that we have. I think as you look and forecast ahead, you know, we see the need for more health professionals is becoming increasingly urgent, and, you know, facing a crisis around, you know, the number of health professionals that we need. So again, it just fuels the work that we do to continue to get out there, talk to young people, and support our students while they're in their training.
Yeah, so that's something you're doing. You just wonder what can healthcare organizations in general do to recruit and retain Native American healthcare professionals.
Absolutely.
It's a task. So I loved the program that you seem to have in terms of working with students, and you start at the pre-college level, which I think is really important. Maybe talk a bit more about that.
Absolutely. You know, we recognize that the earlier you're out there talking to young people as they're forming ideas about what they may see in their futures is a really important time for us to be planting these seeds. One of our favorite things to do is to get out and travel across the state and do hands-on activities with our students, you know, doing some really cool, fun, STEM-based health career exploration. It also is a great opportunity for us to include our students. Our students love to give back. They're, you know, very generous with their time when they can. You know, we understand med school and, you know, yeah, their training programs demand a lot of their time. But when they are available, you know, they will travel with us and we'll, you know, share their stories and journeys with young people, and also with our alumni and our advisory council members. So we're very fortunate to have a giving group of individuals who want to reach back and help be part of that exploration for our young people.
I was thinking back to Patty Lowe again, who would spend her summers or parts of her summers working in the Native communities on developing maybe some videos on history or whatever it might be relating to Native Americans and culture. And she always came back so energized.
Yes, we relate to that. I think we bring a unique perspective to our jobs because most of us at NACHIP come from tribal communities here in Wisconsin or in the Great Lakes region and have either attended UW in some fashion or been associated with UW, so can relate to students, you know, on a firsthand level of what it's like to leave your community and come to school here. And coming from Wisconsin tribes, we also understand the importance of the visibility of employees and staff and faculty of UW-Madison visiting tribal communities and making connections with the community directly.
Yeah, I was thinking about, our college. I was in RM in the College of Ag and Life Sciences, in science, life sciences communication. And so many of our students come from small towns or very rural areas, and it's a huge change to come to a place like UW-Madison.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it makes it makes a real difference in not only the work that we do with visiting tribal communities and hearing directly from community members about what are priorities for them, what do they want to see happening at this educational level, and making those connections so when they see a son, a daughter, a niece or a nephew go to UW-Madison, they've, you know, most likely met us, one of us on staff, and you know, can feel secured knowing that their family member is well taken care of and well supported while they're here.
Yeah, we had. I was thinking about that. I had. I was talking to one of my native students. I can remember, and she said, "You're the first person who called me by my first name. My first professor who called me by my first name, and that apparently had a big impact on her. Just being recognized by somebody." And so the kind of work that you're doing is that, which I think is great. Someone else is wondering in an email, what about medical schools? How can they encourage Native American students to apply? Typically, are these medical schools inclusive and welcoming to Native American students? Danielle, maybe I turn to you for that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I think there are a lot of things that medical schools can do to create a welcoming environment for students. I think first and foremost is, you know, having staff who can support students who, you know, can identify to their experiences, have those relationships with communities and working in partnership with them. I also think having accessible information is also really important. One thing we often hear from students is, you know, how to get access to information and resources. Where do I even start if I want to go to medical school? So being able to have a central place, like a program like NACHIP, where students can go to and say, okay, they have an intentional focus in wanting to reach out to someone like me and offering that kind of support. Nationally, there are other centers like NACHIP at other medical schools who are doing similar work. So, you know, one thing we often hear from students is they're doing their research and they're looking out and seeing what medical schools offer that kind of support, because it's not uncommon for them to be seeking a training home that's going to give them access to training opportunities in Indigenous health, having a sense of community. Do they feel like this is a place where they will belong and they'll have a sense of community? So I feel like those are some top things that we often hear from students about what they're looking for.
Is it typical for a student to go on to become a physician in the same university that they studied in for their undergraduate work and so forth?
That's a really good question. I think it can vary. Ultimately, I feel like that's a very personal choice for a student. You know, if they went to their home state university, for some students, they prioritize not wanting to be too far from home, you know, mm-hmm. and so they may you know, choose to go to that medical school because that's their top priority, right? So I think for every student, it can be an individual choice. And, you know, we see students who do decide to stay close to home here in Wisconsin, but we also serve students who come from other states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why is a diverse healthcare system important?
Yeah, another really, really great question. You know, I think a lot of a big driver for establishing NAACHP is addressing the underrepresentation of Native Americans in the healthcare workforce and having, you know, a physician workforce who can, you know, understand the needs of that community or come from that particular community. I think there's a growing interest in how do we offer culturally congruent care? How do we, you know, encourage cultural humility in our practice and, you know, ensure that we're providing quality care to all patients? And how do we think about how those needs may vary across all communities that we're serving? And so for us, as we're trying to create a space and an opportunity to learn about our people and our communities.
Yeah, really interesting. You work with directly with tribal communities and clinics around the state, as you were talking about, and the rotation. The students can go on a rotation at a tribal clinic. This has got to be. What do they learn typically? What goes on in an internship program like that? And why is it important for them to be at a tribal clinic?
Yeah, for us, being able to provide that opportunity goes back to, you know, how are we supporting workforce development in an intentional way, an opportunity to learn about those opportunities to work in our community clinics. When students go there, we really try to help support a holistic experience. So not only learning with preceptors in the clinic, so learning from those individuals that they're observing or working directly with, and then more broadly learning about how that clinic approaches care in their community, what services that they provide. And healthcare is very much a team sport. So they have an opportunity to work with other health professionals, programs, and services within that community. Additionally, we also encourage students to, you know, if they have an opportunity to go out and learn more about the community at large, attend events. Our preceptors have been very wonderful in, you know, taking students to different community events or going to volunteer with different programs in the community. So they get a more global look or mm-hmm. Learning experience from the community. So something that's really important to us that it's within and beyond the clinic.
And I noticed earlier you said that there are some non-Native students who are involved in this program. How does that work?
Yeah, so we've done a lot of work over the recent years of just providing more Indigenous health focused educational opportunities, one being the tribal clinic rotations, where we have many SMPH students, the School of Medicine and Public Health students, and other health professional programs participating in these rotations. We also have a diverse group of students that sign up for our course. We encourage them to do our course before they participate in a rotation so they get that introduction to treaty agreements, to what is tribal sovereignty, learning about the Indian Health Service. And then we also have a few other programs that our center offers. One is our Distinguished Lecture Series. So this is funded by our Indians into Medicine grant through the Indian Health Service. And we feature 3 public lectures a year. So we bring different Indigenous health scholars from all across the country who will provide a talk on work that they're doing that's addressing and supporting improvement of health in Indian country. And these lectures are open publicly. They're also live streamed. So mm-hmm. for listeners that would love to sign up and be on our listserv, you can visit our website. We also have these lectures recorded. So you can go onto our website and see some of our past lectures. But that's another great opportunity of how we want to make our programs in learning about Indigenous health accessible.
And what's I'm sure we're posting the website up on the Larry Mueller Show page, but for somebody who said, well, where do you go for that?
Absolutely. And I can share the URL for mm-hmm. our website, which is nachp.med.wisc.edu.
That's a long one.
It is. And you can also type in Native American Center for Health Professions, and that will also take you to our website.
And we do have it up. Claire's got it up on our site. On today's, so go to ideas at WPR.org/Larry or talk at WPR.org/Larry and go to today's program, and we have the link to the center and a link, separate link too, although the podcast.
Yes, which is also linked on the website as well.
It's linked on the website. That's how I found it to begin with. So
wonderful.
We are talking with Lauren Cornelius, who is the center's academic program specialist. Danielle Lancey is the director of the Native American Center for Health Professionals. Questions for them, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today as we talk about the Native American Center for Health Professionals and the great work that's going on at the UW-Madison and, of course, across the state. With our various tribe centers. It's great to have our guests today, Lauren Cornelius and Danielle Yancey, with us today. And if you have a question or comment or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Lauren, you did a series of Medicine Talkers podcasts about the different options for healthcare professions. Let's say somebody's interested in a career in the healthcare field. What are the different paths they can take?
Yes, that's a great question, Larry. There's so many different fields of health that fall under the umbrella of health. And one of the things that we've noticed visiting communities is a lack of visibility for, this wide range of health professions that are out there. Mostly students have heard of a doctor or a nurse, but we like to use the podcast to feature a couple other programs that maybe aren't as well known or are starting to gain traction and popularity as a profession to pursue. So one of those that we featured was master's in public health, which is an incredible degree to get and pair with almost any other program that you're interested in. Public health can be paired with a law degree. It can be paired with a health degree. Any of our graduate programs in health can pair with public health master's program, which is, I think, really helpful to our students. We also
What's that degree about? I mean, what are you going to learn in that degree?
Public health is, it depends on the specialty that you are going into, but, you know, let's say, for example, as it relates to law and to public health policy. So kind of thinking about what policies are being put in place that are going to affect health and healthcare, and looking at the population as a whole, and what aspects of health are being determined at a policy level within our country.
Okay, and you were going on, and then I interrupted you.
Yes, many many other things. One of them, we did an episode on physical therapy, which was also very eye-opening, talking about recovery from injury or long-term chronic issues, and how physical therapy can help people optimize their function through life.
So that's a cool one, too. Let's take another call. Weehaw in Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call and for the work that you all do. It sounds really exciting and important. As a community member, I was just wondering, is there any ways for us to be involved and help support the work that you're doing?
Oh, that's a good... Oh, you're happy to answer that question, Danielle.
Well, thank you so much for the call and the comment and the encouraging words. We'd love to connect with you. Again, you can contact us and reach out to us on our website. So both me and Lauren's contact information is listed there. So we'd love to chat with you more. One of our programs that we haven't had an opportunity to highlight yet that is open to the community is our annual Indigenous Health and Wellness Day. So this is a program that's open to middle and high school students and their families across the state. We bring about 100 students to campus each year in April. We do this program in partnership with Madison College, the UW School of Nursing, and the Great Lakes Intertribal Council NARCH program. And we bring students so they get a two-day experience exploring college, hearing from college students directly about their experience. We have a wide range of activities and a keynote speaker. So it's really all about, you know, encouraging continuing education, exploring health careers. So this is an annual program that you can get involved with as a community member, and also really excited to talk with you more about what might be some additional areas that you're interested in. I also appreciate the question about how to support. So NACHIP does have a place where individuals can support our students through scholarships. So we know that the cost of going to a health professional program is certainly there. Our students oftentimes focus 100% on school, so they are unable to have part-time jobs. So we do have our site where you can go to nachip.med.wis.edu/give if you're interested in supporting scholarships for students.
And I'd also add that it can be as simple as sharing a Facebook post or an Instagram post. We find that social media has been a great way to bring awareness to the programs that we're offering, and especially opportunities like Indigenous Health and Wellness Day that Danielle just mentioned, which we just celebrated the 20th year of that program, that has had different homes throughout the years on UW campus, and we are happy to be able to be the current home of the program. So this past year, we brought Alakwa Cox, who is an actor from the Menominee Nation and starred in the Disney Plus show Echo, which is a Marvel show. Mm-hmm. And she was able to present to our students and talk about her experience. And it was a great way to encourage our students to visit our campus and participate in our program. And we will list information on the next upcoming Indigenous Health and Wellness Day on our website. So I'd also encourage anyone listening to continue to check back in on our website and our social media platforms for more information on the 2025 Indigenous Health and Wellness Day.
And the center's recently received some awards too, if I'm not mistaken, or an award, if I'm not mistaken. Talk about that, Danielle.
Oh, thank you. Well, first and foremost, I want to give a shout out to Dr. Brett Benally-Thompson. He is our faculty member of our center. He's the Director of Indigenous Health and Cultural Guidance. He's also a palliative care physician and clinical associate professor. And he is being recognized this year as Physician of the Year by the Association of American Indian Physicians. We're so incredibly proud of him and couldn't think of someone more deserving for this recognition. He's been a tremendous mentor for our students and does a lot to contribute and support the programming that we offer at NACHIP. So I just wanted to give him a shout out for this recent recognition. And then we are also really proud to share that we've been recently re-awarded with the Indians into Medicine grant through the Indian Health Service. This is a 5-year program, grant-funded program four medical schools that have made a commitment to supporting American Indian Alaska Native students into medicine. So we have been re-awarded this grant for the third time. So we're really excited to say that we will have the support to continue our programming through 2029.
And, you know, just this whole program to become a doctor, I got to believe I'm assuming that you try to provide support and help as they're working through that program.
At every stage, yes.
At every stage.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, what do you do? Because I know what school is like, and medical school is really hard.
Absolutely. And I will also add that, you know, in addition to myself, Lauren, Dr. Benali Thompson, I know we also mentioned Melissa Matoxin, who's another member of our team, but there are 10 of us who do this work. I will say that to do it thoughtfully and with the greatest impact is you do need a team. So we have an awesome team of individuals who help us do programming all throughout the different stages of preparing to go to college to become a health professional. We often refer to it as pathway programming. One thing that we really have made an effort to do is to support students throughout that pathway. It can be long, and each phase requires, you know, different things, right? And so we're there to serve as those coaches and advisors along that pathway. And that includes, you know, connecting them with resources, offering that advising, and then also that, you know, student support, which could be cultural programming, community space, that informal mentorship that we provide.
Mike emailed us from Oneida. He's curious about traditional native foods and connection to health, and wonders if maybe that's a future podcast topic.
Oh, that would be a very fun podcast idea. And actually, that would have additional great synergy with our center, because one of our program offerings for our health professional students is a tribal community visit up to the Oneida Reservation, just outside of Green Bay, Wisconsin. And we visit Junhenkwa, which is Oneida's traditional farm, and learn about the traditional food ways to Oneida people, and kind of making that connection back to health and well-being. Students also get a tour of the Oneida Tribal Health Clinic while they're up there as well. So again, kind of reinforcing those connections and networking.
So that sounds like a good podcast. You could do a nice podcast
on that. I
think
we could do a great podcast on that.
We might have season four planned.
I think so.
Take your recorder with you at all times.
Yeah, exactly. I think that would be a great, you know, next step in this podcast is taking the show on the road. So
yeah,
I could see that. And there are so many individuals, too, that in the Oneida community that have some great education in food sovereignty, as well as colleagues that we are familiar with working at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay as well.
So I'm trying to remember. There's been some great success in our last minute. You've been doing this for more than 12 years. Have a number of students gone through successfully in the program?
Absolutely. When NATRIP first started back in, you know, 2012, our community was quite small. And since then, we've grown by 600% in terms of the number of students that are, you know, enrolling in the health professional programs that we serve, particularly in the MD program. And I'm really excited to share that today we have 115 alumni now through our program. So our community continues to grow. And, you know, we're just really honored to be able to provide the support and space for our students, because we don't want the journey to pursue a health professional career to be a bad experience. We want to create a space where they can thrive and fulfill those dreams of becoming healers for our communities.
Well, given the two of you, I'm sure it's one of the main reasons that it's a successful program. I want to thank you both for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Yeah, well, go. Thank you, Larry.
Come on, and thank you, Larry.
Lauren Cornelius and Danielle Yancey from the North American Center for Health Professionals, housed at the UW-Madison. It's great to have them with us today. And we'll get them back, and we can do this again. It's something that'll need updating along the way. And thank you for listening in. You know, these shows are a team effort. Clara Neipert, Joel Patnott, our technical directors, are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our executive director, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on WPR News.